What's your name again for the record, sir?
I am called Earwood, State Coordinator of the Deaf and Hearing Impaired Access Program from the Department of Human Resources. To respond to your question, yes, I do have an advisory committee that represents deaf and hearing impaired professionals, parents, a variety of different groups on to advise me on this program. Yes, ma'am.
Then maybe my question back to Representative Ickes, if I may, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, is that committee, could it not serve this same purpose?
Yes, I believe it could. There is nothing that prevents some of the same people serving. I'm not sure it has the same membership listed here. Does it have the same membership?
The type of membership which is listed in your current bill, perhaps the only modification we might need to make is to add Section C, a member from a Public Utility Commission, and one representative from the telephone company. Other than that, we have a variety of deaf and hearing impaired people on our advisory committee. And as I said, they represent a variety of different groups, professional parents of deaf children, deaf consumers. So probably we just need to add those two to our advisory committee.
Okay, but again, there's no staff that could just be transferred over. Is that right?
No, Mr. Irwin's testimony indicated that there were three staff, two full-time and one part-time. Not contemplated that that staff could absorb this program. I think that's also one reason why we're looking at a separate advisory committee, although it could include some of the, could overlap to some extent. But this is can be a fairly extensive program with a good deal of money involved. And also contemplated that we're not going to be able to do everything in the first year. There are going to have to be some priorities established as to who are the first priorities for receiving these devices. And there's a lot to this. And it's also that we are, as an advisory committee to the PUC, at least for now. It wasn't contemplated as something that would compete with or replace or something that could not also absorb some of the membership.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
Ron, that's a little bit confusing. It looks like if you had dual membership, people belong to both boards, you'd run into conflicts, where you'd have one advisory board advising that they issue a contract to the other people where they sit on the board.
I was really only referring to the types of members of the board, not necessarily the same
individual.
Thank you.
Again, I think one of the reasons is that this is, I view this as a fairly extensive program. We're talking about 24,000 people out there with a 10-cent surcharge and devices that range several hundred dollars and a relay system, trying to do that size of a program would be valuable to have some committee advising specifically on that. Mr. Irwin could explain a number of the other things that the current program does that are very valuable, but it's essentially establishing a network, and it just, it's one of those situations where you're creating something that deserves some specific attention to it, and it's worth, because of its nature, needing an advisory group to help out with, but at the same time, you've already got an existing group. The important thing is that you need to have an advisory group, not stuck on doing it this way. That's the way we contemplated it, but the program and the nature of it would require an advisory group. Section 13 is the coordinator section. Sub 2, again, allows the contracting with governmental agency. Section 14 is eligibility criteria section. And what we're really saying there is that you need to be certified, and that certification implies that you can't use the telephone for the expressive or receptive communication, and also can't have more than one device per household. We are also in sub 3 not requiring the utility itself to provide the device for the deaf. The devices will be provided through the private sector and the companies that are currently doing that. Section 15 provides that the program of distribution be phased in over a 4-year period. In other words, our goal to have these complete distribution and relay system set up would be over 4 years, not necessarily 2. Section 16 is a sunset, fully recognizing that it's the 1989 legislature could make changes in the program, but the program is sunsetted after 4 years. Section 17 is a emergency clause, and the reason the emergency clause is in there is to allow the Public Utility Commission, since this has the authority for differential rates, would allow the Public Utility Commission to continue with the existing telephone assistance plan or modify that until they get the rules in the new program developed.
Thank you very much. Ray, do you want to comment?
For the record, I'm Ray Gribling. I represent Pacific Northwest Bell, and we support the bill.
Thank you very much. Eric?
Also, for the record, Eric Stashen, on behalf of Osberg and the Citizens Utility Board, we also support the bill. I guess I would just say that this bill is the product of a lot of hours of all the parties in both informal meetings, in meetings of the subcommittee, and I very much appreciate all the effort that went into it from all the various parties. I think this is a great leap forward. There are a lot of issues that that we in the telecommunications utilities don't agree on, but I think it's a tribute to all the parties that when there is a common goal, we can get together and indeed come up with what I think is a very worthwhile product.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
You want to complete the circle now. I, too, support the bill. I worked on it, but not nearly as hard as some of the other people, but was on the subcommittee.
Well, I will add to that. I think the subcommittee, chaired by Representative Ickes and other members, Representative Anderson, Representative Berea, has done, I think, a marvelous job. And the people they've been working with, Ray Gribling, Nick Stashen, and I think others. With the POC, were you involved, Charlie? Okay, and
great deal.
Ashley was involved, and the other telephone representatives. We really appreciate it. It's a nice job, nice bill. And with that, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the -5 amendments to House Bill 2663.
Okay, we have a motion to adopt the amendments -5 to House Bill 2663. Do we have, why don't you come on up here, probably be better. We'll get you on the right side of the fence. Is there any further discussion on the part of the committee on the motion?
The motion to set the amendments.
The motion to, these are the amendments, -5. Is there any objection to the amendments? Not. Could we have a motion for the bill as amended?
Mr. Chairman, I would move adoption of House Bill 2663 as amended, and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Excuse me, is there a Ways and Means referral?
Mr. Chair, I discussed this with the Speaker last night. Because this is in the other funds category, there is not a necessity to refer the bill to Ways and Means. However, it will be necessary to make sure that in the Public Utility Commission's budget and the expenditure limitation on that budget that the proper adjustment is made to take into account the increase in other funds. But according to the Speaker, it's not necessary to refer the bill to Ways and Means.
There wasn't an initial referral.
No, there was not.
All right, that's fine. So we do have a motion then to send to the floor with a due pass recommendation, House Bill 2663 as amended.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm not sure I can do this. I haven't had a lot of practice, but before I do this, I just wanted to make one statement on behalf of the people that have worked on it and some of the people that are here, and that is that we want this bill. Thank you.
Representative Maria has been showing me what he's been learning every time I see him in the elevator, so. Representative Anderson, you want to add to that, too?
Just call that close.
How about like you, Ray? You've learned, too. Everybody's learned. Appreciate it. It's been an interesting experience. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Maria.
Aye. Yes.
Representative
Gilman. Aye. Representative Parkinson.
Aye.
Representative Peterson.
Aye.
Representative
Soa. Aye.
Mr. Chair.
Aye. The bill passes. Representative Ekus, what is your wish on carrying this? Do you want to carry this on the floor?
Yes,
aye. Fine. Representative Ekus will carry 2663 on the floor. Thank you, everybody. Thank you very much. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, before I go on, I do want to express my great appreciation to all the people that participated in the working group, Public Utility Commissioner staff, public interest groups, telephone companies, and the citizens and the Department of Human Resources that have representatives that have worked on all of the aspects of the bill, including 3162, and it really has been a really enjoyable and it's been a unique process, and this bill is a product of a lot of work, and I appreciate all of their efforts.
Thank you very much. It is, I think, an important bill. We appreciate all your work, and I think this should be, as you've watched the floor the last couple of days, we've had some bills that have had difficulty. I do not believe this will be one of them. With that, I think to close the work session on House Bill 2663. We'll be in momentary recess while we check and see if we can get Representative Agrams on the next bill, which is House Bill 3097. Pat, will you call him in his office and see if we can get him? Is that where he is, Ready? I'd like to call us back into session. We're missing. Representative Peterson's outside. Let me get her.
I'll go get her.
You got to come on.
I'm not trying to run your affairs.
Before we go into the next work session, let me ask the committee if we can have unanimous consent to allow Representative Johnson to vote on the last measure we passed out. Is there any objections? If not, if the clerk will
I vote aye.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye.
Okay. We will now open our work session then on House Bill 3097, Lady Destination Resorts. And I would welcome the group here, Representative Anderson, Representative Agrams, who is the chief sponsor of the bill, Russ Niebuhr, and Dick Bennett. I understand that you have not quite closed, but are close, but a couple of philosophical problems are hanging you up.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, if I may,
right.
Representative Bernie Agron's District 53, we've had highly productive discussions, several of them, And I think that the committee administrator has provided you with a breakdown, a matrix dated April 24th, amendments proposed to House Bill 3097, which has distilled the points that came under discussion and their resolution. And for the most part, as you can see, Carol, did you highlight those two?
No, I didn't highlight them
okay.
for everybody.
All right. Okay. 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 Just so that you should understand, the remaining points are in subsection section 4, subsection 6, and then a couple of new sections that have been suggested by Mr. Benner. That I tell you, I got to where I said, you know, we've done 90% of this thing. There are a couple little points here. We all need to get on with it. I don't think that any of them need to hang us up. I think the best thing to do so we keep some movement going here is rather than for us who have been negotiating, why don't we just come before the committee, identify all the things that we have agreed on, these other couple little points, and then just seek the advice of the committee and say, I'm perfectly willing to have the committee make these decisions, and then I think we'll all get done faster.
Thank you, Representative. One thing I would like to avoid is to, using a phrase that you had given me some time ago, is that we don't end up on this bill having a feeding frenzy on the floor.
Right.
And I like that phrase.
That usually happens on Thursdays.
Yesterday. If we put this out today, it might end up on the floor next Thursday.
Yes.
I think what might be most helpful for the committee, Representative Agnes, if you would, and your colleagues, Representative Anderson, and others, tell us roughly what you've agreed to and gone over, and then the couple of points that are still hanging so we can see clearly where we're at.
Okay. Andy, why don't you do it? Do you mind?
Well, the first minor area, as far as I can. Oh.
We still have a little minor.
The original bill called for.
And will you use the floor, Mike?
Andy Anderson. the original draft of the bill called for it to be available for rental, the units, 48 weeks. In the working group, for reasons of things like ski areas, I had suggested at one time 40 weeks, leaving 12 weeks of skiing available that an owner wouldn't have to rent it. We talked in the group about other various areas. We had brought back, Bernie and I, 42. Dick suggested 45. So we have a minor point there of 3 weeks. And I guess whatever the committee desire, if maybe we could, if you want to come back to that, that's all right. That was a
that's that. I take it's not a major issue.
No.
All right. Why don't we come back to it?
Yeah. The next issue redefines land qualifying for small destination resorts to include secondary resource lands. I think that we might let Dick speak to that, but I don't think we had any big hang-ups on that. I think the language was almost the same in the two deals, and I think we just weren't sure about that. I don't really know why it's highlighted.
Carol, would you help us with that?
Yes. I highlighted that because clearly that's a section that defines the qualifying land for the small resorts, for the small-scale resorts. And in your draft, Representative Agrons, you had included secondary resource lands, and in Mr. Benner's draft, he did not include that, and he addressed the issue of secondary resource lands in sections 11 and 12.
Oh.
So that's your point of difference.
Yes. Let's go, Peterson. Go ahead.
Do we define small destination resort in here? Can you point me to that?
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Peterson, we define it as between 25 with a maximum of 75 units. The large ones of the prior bill we dealt with
away
were
150
units.
And there are other variations, Representative Peterson, that are also specified down below in subsection 6 of section 4 of the bill. Do you have a Hand and Gross version?
Do I
do. They have that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have two Hand and Gross versions, I think, and but it's a, that is that the same? Well, no, it isn't the same.
We're working from Benner.
Well, which one is...
424-3
Benner. LC2 is the Agron Anderson version. LC3 are some minor variations from Benner.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dick Benner.
Richard Benner for 1,000 Friends. The difference on that point... The difference between the two versions on that point, that is, where you can have one of these smaller resorts, is, if you remember, in the original bill said you can have one of these small resorts in exceptions areas or non-resource lands. And that amounts to about 1 million acres statewide. Representative Agron's came in with an amendment that would have authorized them as well on certain classes of farmland and forest land. When we discussed that, I raised an objection to that because of the number of acres involved, which in our estimation was too many. Then we shifted the discussion a little bit to talk about secondary lands. Representative Agron's suggested that we authorize resorts on secondary lands. My position was that we tell the commission to consider whether to authorize them on secondary lands. That's really what it boils down to. And what I did is, in Section 11, wrote language that would direct the commission to consider whether to authorize these smaller resorts on secondary lands. And in Section 12, direct the commission to do its final thing on secondary lands by January 1, 1988.
May I add to that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Agron.
If I may, just to further amplify that, coming back to me, I wish I was as expert in all this stuff as all you are, because I'm still learning the byways of your language in this stuff here. But I guess that is one of the key issues there, and thank you for highlighting that, Carol. Our intent has been to define as well as we can the circumstances under which these smaller destination resorts can be sited, and then having done so, permit the counties to then manage the process. We first had to work our way through the kinds of lands we're talking about. And because there is some kind of a task force that's been working for some period of time to define these secondary resource lands, it eventually made sense to say, okay, let's call it that. I was a little impatient in the original drafting of it, saying, very frankly, these people have been fumbling around long enough, and we're only here for a very brief period, so we'll just establish some criteria and say, you know, the low-quality agricultural lands, the low-quality forest lands, and we named that by site and said, we've done it, you see. Okay. Now, Mr. Benner convinced me that if we do that, particularly with regard to much of the forest land and whatnot, we're talking about all of Eastern Oregon or something, you know, and I understand, and I have really no major problem with that, other than want to get something decided so that we can have a decision on it. So I was then willing to say, okay, fine, then let's talk about putting them on secondary resource lands, but what can we do to assure that we're not going to still be talking about secondary resource lands when we next convene, you know, and that this will be done. I'm told that the project is nearing closure, and that's fine. So then, fine, if that's the case, now let's do it on secondary resource lands if they meet all these other criteria. But then as I looked at headed section 11, it said the commission shall consider. I say, well, wait a minute. That's not what we had in mind. We've established all these strict criteria as to the nature of what a small destination resource would be, but then we've got to come back to the commission with it. Why can't we manage this at the local level? And I guess that, if anything, Dick, you and I might agree, might be our major point that needs resolution.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson.
Mike, if the committee could turn to Mr. Benner's Hand and Growth, the very last page, maybe we can make some progress here as a suggestion. Section 11 is what Representative Agron just referred to, which tells the commission to consider. However, in Section 12, I believe the committee has before you, and I think Dick, she gave you a -4 amendment, which has a one or two word change. Section 12, if Representative Agron's and my amendment were adopted, would say the commission shall adopt and submit a definition of secondary resource lands and uses permitted on secondary resource lands to the committee by July 31, 1988. Now, it gives us well over a year to get, again, to extend this process that we've been working on.
Representative Anderson, let me, I guess I'm getting a little confused. You had mentioned a -4 amendment?
There it is.
There's a little one-pager, two-liner, -4.
So that would be the commission shall submit. Let me see.
The commission shall adopt and submit.
Oh.
That's the word shall, insert adopt and.
Submit, okay.
Mr. Chairman, it would be my.
Now, let me ask you that. Are you still leaving in 11 or are you leaving? No. You take 11 out?
I would say take 11 out. I think Representative Agron agrees with that. I'm not sure about Dick. But this would be a directive to the commission to get on with it in a time certain of a year and several months. Right.
Representative Berea.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess my concern is the concern that was brought up by Mr. Ross, whether what you're addressing takes care of the problem of creating small resorts that would lead to the siting of additional roadside motels.
Well, may I address right. that issue? We haven't, as a committee, yet looked
okay.
through some of the other criteria that have been set forth and that we have agreed on. Okay. And which, and the guts of them are in section 4(6), where we're talking about the location of the resort, the number of units, you see, and then you get to another one, which Mr. Benner has inserted, which I have no problem, minor problem in semantics, but you know, section F would say the resort shall primarily provide access to a recreational resource such as a hot spring, a ski slope, or a fishing stream, such as, not I assume we're not exclusively that, which can only be reasonably enjoyed in a rural area and provide lodging and other services in support of access to that resource. You see, we've really drawn it down pretty fine, in addition to which the number of lodgings, the seats, you know, the uses to which they're made, are very tightly subscribed and all oriented toward addressing that very issue.
Thank you.
Dick, let me ask you to respond to that, and I think Jim Ross is here. If Jim wants to come up and say anything, we'd be happy to take that, Jim, as we work through this. Go ahead, Dick.
This is responding to the question about the criteria that describe what a small resort is, or the back on the secondary lands one.
Well, I think back on this, and then we can go forward on these other items, but I think back on this suggestion of changes to Section 12.
Okay. This morning, I read the language in Section 12 that I drafted. This is in my amendments, -3, I guess. I read that to Jim Ross over the phone to see what his reaction to it was, and he said that he thought that was fine. The change that is suggested by Representative Anderson, I think, is acceptable. provided that we're talking about putting it into my amendments, because we still have the difference, and I might as well make sure we all understand the difference. If you go with my amendments, you are not directing the commission to authorize destination resorts in secondary lands. You're directing them to adopt a definition of secondary lands by this date. So you need Section 11 if you want them to consider by that date, or, and make up their minds by that date, whether they want destination resorts and secondary lands.
And you see, that's the sticking point.
That's the sticking
point. And we're saying that, quite the opposite, that the legislature has decided that destination resorts can be cited under all these strict criteria on secondary resorts.
Can I?
Go ahead.
Let me give you the argument that I've made why we shouldn't tie the commission's hand on this. And I think Representative Agron's touched upon it in his opening remarks. There has been a process underway sponsored by LCDC for the last 16 months or so with about 30 participants, everybody, trying to define secondary lands and the uses that might be authorized on them. We're getting much closer.
I'm satisfied personally to not try to, it's never been our intention to disrupt some process that's already in progress. I would say that. So, you know, philosophically, I'm not opposed to having the whole issue of the identification of secondary resource lands completed, and don't want to do anything that would muddy that process, particularly since I'm told it's close to closure. So fine, why not? That would be foolish to upset that apple cart now.
Mr. Chairman? I'm being awful mouthy. I apologize if I'm bothering anybody. But
don't apologize for something you can't help.
Couldn't we put a statement in there that it's the policy of the state to develop smaller resort destination resorts on some secondary lands and let the commission by rule come up with the procedure, then that shouldn't upset Mr. Benner's secondary lands thing, I don't think, Dick.
Representative Parkinson,
it wouldn't be on all your land, all the secondary land.
I think that's what Jim Ross was suggesting.
On some
a minute ago.
Secondary land.
Such secondary lands as the commission deems appropriate.
Yes, but the language we've seen in either draft wouldn't do that.
Not yet. No.
Okay. Well, let me ask you. Let me ask you if we can do this. A couple of our members have had to go to the speaker's office for a meeting, and with word that I'll call them when we're ready. I'm wondering if we could temporarily close the work session on this bill and ask the four or five of you if you can, within the next hour, half hour. I think we're very close here. If we could come up with some resolution of the language that might solve that while we go on to our next work session on another bill, and if you can come back with closure, we can move and move it out.
Okay.
Is that? Yes, Representative Rhea.
I'd like them, if with their permission, to discuss Mr. Ross's amendment and Representative Parkinson's idea of sunset.
Yes, we can do that too. I'm asking all of them. The sunset you can consider whether you want to do that. You suggested 8 years. I don't know that I have any great problem with it. Because if it, when it goes to the Senate, there's going to be some opportunity to do some things too. But I think that this issue about some maybe is a way to move it. It develops a certain policy, but leaves the issue of specifics open. So if
Mr. Chairman, one other thing.
Yes, Representative Parkinson.
One other thing. Somewhere there, you've got a definition of the uses that would be allowed on these small destination resorts. I think there are about three examples. I think it was such as. Would it be appropriate to put the language in there, such as, but not limited to? So that would be clear that those,
that's what they intend
such
for.
As, but not limited to.
Those only to be illustrative and not specific. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
I want you all to understand that one of the issues here for me, now you're all good colleagues and I know you want to do something, I want to do it too, and but Dick Benner is one of my constituents, so I have to be particularly cognizant of his interests. So I think you have to understand that's part of the... go ahead.
Yeah, transcend something like that.
All right, we'll close the work session on this bill. No, not you. Oh, yeah, you too. That's true. We have to go there. That's right. I thought you were going with them. No. Okay, all right.
Okay. Yeah. No, never.
I would like to open the work session on House Bill 2936, and I would ask Mike, Representative McCracken, you might want to come over. This, you're the chief sponsor of the bill. Representative Gilman has taken the lead on the bill, and Diane Luther, do you have anybody else you want up? George, is that it?
Phil Fell from Lea City.
All right, Phil. Is Phil Fell here?
He's not, but I presume he'll be back shortly.
Okay. Well, why don't we be in recess for just a couple minutes until he comes back and we'll...
I can go get him.
Yeah, why don't you, Diane? That'd be fine.
I will be refilling.
Okay.
Census for about 2 weeks now, it seems like, and I think we're there. It's a difficult one. It's making a mandate to the cities, and philosophically I'm a little uncomfortable with that, but then when you consider the issue and the fact that some cities are dragging their feet, I think it's important that we do this. So now you'll first of all go to section 1 of 2936, and that's as it is in the original bill. And then from line 11 through 24 of the original bill, we insert Legislative Council 2936-6. And I hope you all have, though, a copy. Section 2 says, in zones pertaining permitting densities of 8 or more dwellings per acre, residential care facilities are defined under ORS 43, you know the number, 400, shall be allowed as conditional use. Then we go on to say that cities and counties will amend their plans at periodic review and occurring after January 1st, 1988. Now, this is probably the area that we had the most trouble. The mental health people would have liked to have this done within the next 2 years, and really by that date all cities have provisions. The way this is written now, it conceivably could be 1995 before provisions would be allowed in all city comp plans. But then after that date, no city or county shall enact or enforce zoning ordinances or impose conditions which would preclude siting of residential care facilities. And then it exempts cities with populations of fewer than 2,500. Section 4. Section 5 directs the LCDC to look at sightings and what we're doing with that as a problem, and come back and report to us 2 years from now.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
Question of Phil. The density here, what's that, multifamily?
Yes. Philip Fell, League of Oregon Cities. Representative Parkinson, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Parker.
It's already pretty much customarily allowed by most city ordinance to be located in commercial or industrial, whatever?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parkinson, in most cities, these facilities are allowed, I believe, primarily in residential zones, both single-family and multifamily.
Both single and multi?
Mr. Chairman, Diane Luther, Mental Health Association of Oregon, Representative Parkinson. This bill actually will have no effect on most cities. It would only affect those cities that up until now have not made provision for their residential care facilities in their zones. And I believe most cities around the state, I wouldn't say most, but the majority of cities around the state have already done so. So,
how would it affect Bend?
I think that Bend is probably would not be greatly affected by this bill. But I'm not absolutely sure myself when I say that.
I just seem to remember Ben from prior sessions. This bill seems like I've seen it before.
I'm surprised you've seen a lot of things before.
Yeah, do we need the bill now, or are you saying do we really need the bill or not, Diane?
I think bill would have a real beneficial effect in those communities that are trying to locate residential care facilities, but where cities have neglected to provide for them in their zoning ordinances.
Phil,
does it have anything to do with the Fairview issue?
No, sir.
You can't move Fairview in any city. Mr. Chairman, Representative
McCracken, state from District 36, I'm not so sure that you could say that Fairview will not enter into the picture. Well, first of all, what the bill intends to do is to make it clear that you don't discriminate in providing housing to people who are handicapped for mental reasons. Well, we shouldn't discriminate for any reason, really. We are maintaining one of the largest institutions for the mentally retarded in the United States, and the United States Department of Justice, joined now by the Healthcare Financing Administration, is saying that they're determined that the state of Oregon no longer content to warehouse people and to deprive them of their civil rights. And what's, I think, going to have to happen is a much more rapid acceleration of residential care facilities for these individuals so that they could be treated more humanely and closer to communities. And often there are problems raised before city councils or county commissioners from neighbors who might object. And to the extent that this bill will assist in having cities overcome that hurdle through the planning process, then that's going to benefit. What the state ultimately has to do as it looks at Fairview, as it looks at damage, as it looks at the state hospital here in Salem. It's inevitable, and this does smooth it up. The amendments, I think, go pretty far in the direction of cities. I'm glad to see the Section 5. I think that having a more intensive look at this through the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use will help. And if there are some problems accompanying the biennium, I imagine the 65th Assembly would be maybe more responsive. We'll see. If there's some real problems, well, heck, we can just put a prison in some city that's giving us difficulty. Anyway, so
you're trying to be funny, but I don't want you to scare the members of this committee off.
Well, just a message to Mr. to the cities,
right, Representative Park.
I don't know who to direct the question at, and maybe it'd be the Marion County zoning men. I don't know, Russ. But what would be the criteria a city would normally use when granting a conditional use for one of these facilities? What would they say that it should be located in this R2 or whatever it is, but not over there in that R2? What criteria do they use?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Russ Niebuhr, Marion County Chief Planner. I'm also a planner for Kaiser, so I do get into urban issues. You're talking about facilities that can accommodate up to 16 people plus the staff necessary to help them. Now, not all the facilities are going to have that level of occupancy. But you're talking about what are the needs for off-street parking. You're talking about the needs for fencing or buffering next to other uses. You're talking about not getting them down at the end of cul-de-sacs and dead-end streets where you could have traffic problems during visitation hours and these kinds of things. And these kinds of facilities have more of a visitation issue associated with them than typical multifamily dwellings do. So that those are the kinds of things that I think local jurisdictions will be looking at when they develop their standards for issuing conditional use permits on these kinds of uses. And many jurisdictions may find that they really, because it is only required in multifamily zones, that they don't have circumstances that are going to create problems, and they can go ahead and allow them as permitted outright uses. And I think that's what the agencies would like to see, is to have it permitted rather than conditional.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
Russ, would these homes, I'd assume they would have different kind of populations or different kind of mentally handicapped folks. Could the council put conditions on that would restrict it to one type or another? What I'm thinking of is, do you have a mentally handicapped folks, say, with a record of sexual offenses? Could this happen, that there would be cottage with that type of folks in there?
Sorry,
whoever. And then the next question is a condition. Would the city then not grant a conditional use, say, next to a school or something?
Mr. Chairman, that kind of situation would be rare. In the sense that in this state right now, the types of people that we are locating in housing facilities do not have criminal backgrounds. Most of those people are either in the jails or in the hospital for a long period of time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure of that, because the way they're downsizing Woodburn and downsizing the state hospital and everything, those people got to be out in the community somewhere. If they're not in these group homes, they're somewhere besides in a secure facility.
Yes, Mr. Chair, they are out there in the community. For the most part, they're on the street, or they're in single room occupancy kinds of hotel situations. But they are not for the most part in housing kinds of situations, because our housing is extremely. We have an extreme shortage of housing for the mentally ill in this state, and the people that are able to get into residential care facilities for the most part are those that are in the best shape. They're the ones that are the most stabilized and the easiest to deal with, and not the more serious folks.
Bill? Mr. Chairman,
yes,
if I might.
Go ahead,
Representative Parkinson, in subsection 2 of section 3 is wording that says, after periodic review, no city or county shall enact or enforce zoning ordinances or impose conditions which would preclude siting of residential care facilities in zone permitting densities of 8 or more dwellings per acre. So I guess it's going to boil down to an issue of interpretation. I think some lawyers would say that if a city was using the conditional use process to discriminate against almost all types of occupants for these kinds of uses, that they would either be challenging it in the courts, or they would be back before this legislature in 2 years to try and get that pinned down. And I don't think Phil or myself are suggesting that the cities are inclined in that direction, or that that's likely to happen. It could happen, but I think generally cities and counties get good legal advice about constitutional rights and being careful about how you use the conditional use process to really deal with the land use related effects of that. And you cited several examples, and when I was listening to some of them, I felt like maybe there were conditions that could apply to some of them that would not be overtly discriminatory. And in others, I felt like probably it would be inappropriate to use a conditional use process to try and preclude those people from living.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
I guess it all boils down, Russ, and you say maybe now even they don't all have conditional use ordinances. You're saying then after periodic review, these homes could be sited anywhere in any multifamily dwelling zoning. Is that what it says? I think it does.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parkinson, I think it says that, except that in ordinances there are conditional uses that are considered to be almost the equivalent of an outright permitted use subject to certain specified preconditions. There are other ordinances that treat that as a review process and a compatibility test and where conditions can actually be created to deal with specific compatibility issues that arise during the public hearing. And so there is room for creativity in there, and I guess I'm suggesting to the committee that this doesn't rule out the possibility of some unfortunate abuses, but I think generally most jurisdictions are careful about getting into those kinds of abuses.
Mr. Chairman, I guess, Russ, what I'm trying to do is not support something that would allow a city to have absolutely no say over whether a group home of 16 could be located, say, next to a senior center where it could cause some problems, and maybe next to a school, maybe some other sense of abuse. Because it looks like there would be legitimate times when the city would want to impose conditions. So the best interests of all of you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parkinson, the amendments before you today are in good part at the request of cities. It is our feeling that they will adequately meet the concerns that you have raised. I guess our base concern is that we will have people in our communities who have been pushed out of institutions, and the choice which faces us is whether they will be in supervised conditions in which they can receive whatever help is necessary and transition back into full community membership in an environment in which our citizens are comfortable, or whether they'll just be there. So we feel that these amendments are a good first shot at protecting everybody's civil rights.
I'd like to pursue that further. I don't see anything in the bill, though, that gives you any authority as a city to restrict the instances that Representative Parkinson was talking about. Should point that to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, let me give you a specific example that was raised by the city of Eugene. Eugene has a condition that they commonly attach to these facilities that no two facilities shall be sited within 400 feet of each other. The purpose for that is really twofold. One, not to have to prevent a specific neighborhood in the city from becoming kind of a magnet for facilities.
I understand what that is.
And secondly, to give them some flexibility in location. And they frequently exercise that and authorize facilities based on those types of conditions.
Okay, that condition, that's just great, but would they, it doesn't address the issue that Representative Parkinson brought up. And I don't believe this bill does address that issue. Are there other statutes out there that allow the city's flexibility to deal with his scenario that said that you wouldn't want a facility next to a senior center? Are there other statutes in the books that would deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I'm afraid I don't know of any other statutes that specifically allow us to do that. I believe that that is commonly done in those jurisdictions now, that issue conditional use.
I guess I'd ask Russ, suppose that were proposed. We'll use that scenario that somebody wants to start a group home next to a senior center. What avenues would that senior center have to resist having that cited next door?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, as a conditional use, it's a quasi-judicial action, and the state law provides that there must be notice to the adjacent property owners at least, and they go beyond that, and an opportunity for a hearing, and that would result, if the decision had been made at the staff level or by a hearings officer, it would give you an opportunity for another hearing beyond that. And I think the jurisdiction would have the ability, under its conditional use section, to impose conditions to try and address the compatibility issue if it could be resolved that way. If it gets to the point...
You don't think the section of the bill that says you can't, that effectively says that the cities can't set any ordinances that would preclude siting, you don't believe that eliminate that... That eliminates the city's ability to control such an issue as the one I described.
Representative Johnson, I think a city could condition it to the point where, in the city's good judgment, they felt that the use would still be
feasible on the site, but the developers of the use might pencil it out and say, in order to comply with these conditions, the costs have been raised to such an extent that it is no longer feasible. And that's why I mentioned that you might end up in court arguing whether or not, by the conditions that were imposed, the city in effect had made it unfeasible to locate a facility in that location.
I see what you're getting to.
I can't see it.
I'm Tim Maria.
I finished on this? Sorry.
Mr. Chairman,
is it on this issue? Go ahead, Diane.
I just wanted to clarify the purpose for the language in the bill is to address situations where a city or a neighborhood might adopt an ordinance that would say that would be so stringent as to preclude the location of any residential care facilities in that area. For example, requiring a large setback, for example, from the sidewalk or something from the street, where no house in that entire area or apartment in that entire area has a setback like that. And what we were trying to accomplish there was that the conditions would not be so drastic as to preclude any residential care facilities. It's my belief that a city could do the kind of thing that Representative Parkinson was talking about, for example, saying that they will not locate a facility next to a school, because that means that a facility could be located a couple of blocks away. It wouldn't preclude siting of the facility. So we're just trying to achieve a very bottom line kind of situation there.
Representative Berea.
I'm finished, all right.
Mr. Chair, people on the panel, I guess I'm concerned with Section 3, Sub 1. Cities and counties shall amend ordinances to come up as part of a periodic land use plan review occurring after January 1st, 1988. I have several questions. First, are there any cities or counties that are having their periodic land use plans reviewed before January 1st, 1988? Does someone want to speak to that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Berea.
Ask that question.
Marion County is due to receive its notice on periodic review in June of this year and would, under that, have 6 months to submit, which means that it would be occurring during the latter part of 1987 and would have to be submitted and be reviewed by LCDC prior to January 1 of 88. And I think the intent of this provision is to just eliminate dropping another unexpected issue on those people that are very close to going through the process and setting a triggering mechanism that would only catch those that are beginning after January.
Mr. Chair, second part of that question. In terms of when periodic land use plans are reviewed or up for review, how many years is that? Seven.
Four and seven.
So in other words, under this bill, Marion County would not have to comply for seven more years with this? Mr. Chair, okay. I'll have some problems with this section.
Perhaps Representative Berea, we had problems, and that's part of the compromise here, to get everyone on board, and we're still not a real good coalition to be we're trying. And yes, it's not soon enough from my point of view. I know it's not soon enough from Diane's point of view. But it's maybe too soon for some other people's point of view, too.
Representative Parkinson.
Aren't you glad I'm asking all the questions you were asking?
Well, I just got to be careful I don't go to sleep. Go ahead.
Well, I guess the question to Russ. Russ, it looks like a real conflict to me. In Section 2, you say they shall be allowed as a conditional use. You go down to 913, and it says the county shall not impose conditions. And if there aren't conditions on a conditional use, I'll eat my hat. I think it's a basic conflict. Isn't it a basic conflict? It says it allows it a conditional use, then you go down there and it says you cannot impose conditions. It just says it real plain.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Parkinson, when you draft a zoning ordinance, you can set up your conditional use process in two ways. One of them is you can say, here is a class of uses, these adult facilities.
let's do a study, and let's decide like Eugene did on what kinds of basic standards we are going to impose. Then you write your ordinance that says these are a conditional use, but as long as they meet these standards, the conditional use permit will be granted. And you will only be denied a conditional use if you don't meet these standards. In other words, it's very clear and objective in terms of what those standards are. And I think under those circumstances, you really wouldn't call those conditions. What the wording in that section is referring to is for those jurisdictions who say, we're just going to list adult facilities as a conditional use, and we're not going to prescribe standards that are going to apply in all cases, we'll consider each case on its own merits. And when we consider each case on its own merits, are we, in reviewing that individual case, imposing conditions that are going to preclude the opportunity for those kinds of facilities to be located in that location? And there is a difference there. And as I say, it may be subject to interpretation. I think the sponsors of the bill are thinking that those conditions that they're referring to are generic conditions that apply throughout the zone, and that there could be cases where a county or a city would actually deny a facility in a particular location if it was incompatible. Those are really standards.
Representative Anderson, then Representative Soa.
Mr. Chairman, my reading of 3-2
yes.
would show me that the skids would be greased to approve about 98% of the applications, even though they didn't have ordinances that permitted it, because it says very clearly they can't impose conditions to prevent it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, as we have met over the last couple of weeks, I think that we had agreement that the purpose of this language is to prohibit those conditions which are clearly intended specifically to prevent the siting of any facilities. It is, from a city perspective, important that we be able to impose conditions which will allow us to satisfactorily determine that such a facility is appropriate in a certain area. You may wish to ask, and those were the instructions that were given to Legislative Council to draft these, you may wish to ask Legislative Council down to confirm that this language
doesn't. Mr. Chairman, I'm not saying you can't deny, but I'm saying this is pretty clear.